thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for this opportunity. So my name is Regis Chiko. I'll be talking about building resilience in agricultural research, and I want to emphasize that this is in the context of resource-limited farming communities in Africa. So I work with colleagues from IIT, International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. Yeah, just to make things light, my talk is on resilience building, and very simplistic is the ability to keep moving forward and achieve goals through times of adversity, if you want to just kind of layman language to kind of talk. But yeah, we want to focus on risk reduction by increasing the adaptive capacity of people and their agricultural ecosystems on which they depend, enabling farmers to meet current and future food needs while coping with uncertainty. So that would be kind of one of the classic definitions. And then the challenge is to fundamentally build and restore the ability of ecosystems to buffer change. That's the big issue here. And I'll give examples of what some of the work we are doing under Africa Rising Research in Sustainable Intensification for the Next Generation, mostly from Malawi. So how do we get the greatest gains on small farms? And I'll be quick to say, in fact, yesterday I attended a few sessions, and this concept is really coming back very often, that soils as the resource base for production is where we have to also work on. Building soil fertility. In Africa, rain-fed agriculture with uncertainty in rainfall and so on, we want to use even very simple methods to increase water availability on the farms. And increasing resilience can also be achieved through crop diversification and local utilization of the crops. Now, this is a graph, those of you who have done production ecology, every teacher will use this graph to when you start. So, with our extension partners, even though they've not gone through university, we want them to understand exactly that this is the starting point, and we are trying to minimize the pests, the diseases, the weeds, because they will reduce our productivity, but also as much as we can try to manage the nutrients and water. Now, over the past 5-6 years, I like science to be in class with students and so on, but I also draw a lot of, I'm so motivated when talking to farmers who are so diverse. And in many cases, for example, this is a slide from Malawi, 80% of these farmers will be illiterate. Now, the challenge is to communicate effectively to them science. So we have to demystify science even with illiterate farmers. And then with confidence, they will be able to implement life-changing technologies. So we have diverse farmers with a gradient of resource endowment, but also literacy is the key issue in terms of consumption of knowledge. So how do we become relevant to all these farmers? So we need technologies that are robust, which in a way they must perform across a range of environments, and also that are not intimidating to farmers, that are within reach of the majority of the farmers that we want. In science, in chemistry, we talk of activation energy. We need to be able to climb that hurdle before we can move on. So I'll give three case studies on how some of our approaches in Africa Rising, as part of Feed the Future, how we think we can practically try to increase the resilience. And I'll show cases why sometimes it's very difficult and how do we target our technologies. So soil fertility, poor soils, basically a lot of farmers are trapped. So I'd call that a poverty trap. Now look at this example. Many of you will be very humbled This is done by hand. A lot of labor that is put in to make those ridges. Farmers will then produce crops upon the rains on those ridges. So it's a lot of labor that goes in. Now, look at this. After all that labor, on this side, the other side of the slide, you can see it's a control plot where nutrients have not been applied. And with a little bit of nutrient application, you see some good response. So this would show that nutrients are key. Otherwise, all that labor will go to waste. So a part of building the resilience will be working with farmers to use different resources they have to be able to express the very nice genotype, maize, beautiful maize, but we will not be able to express that with no nutrients. Now, this is a typical example of how soils operate, interactions with nutrients. You'll see that there is low soil fertility there. Whatever you do, all the nutrients, NPK plus even micronutrients, you still get no more than 2 tons as a ceiling for the poor soils. And for medium soil, then they become responsive. And at least you go to 5 tons per hectare by applying all the nutrients required. And indeed, this is simple to interpret. The difference between that becomes a soil factor. It could simply be the same farmer with different portions of the farm. One is degraded part of the farm, the other is not. Where do you invest your nutrients? And so with same, or this could be a case of two farmers, neighboring farmers. Actually, with one of my chief, our leader in Africa Rising in Southern Africa, Professor Matete, we coined a term. There's a book called The River Between from South Africa, Alan Paton. But we moved through one of our communities, and then we said the road between. The other farmer, same soil, basically the pedology and everything, the same, but completely different crop responses. And that becomes a big issue. So yes, we have big, large, very large, very alarming yield gaps, and we need to do something to close that. And that's part of how we can build resilience. That the people we work with, the extension, understanding the potential from within, and how we can use simple technologies to do that. So do we have a panacea to solve this? Most of our approach in Africa Rising is to rehabilitate soils through growing legumes. Grow more legumes, you get good quality biomass, then it's a trajectory towards achieving resilience. We can also rehabilitate soils by organic materials, but the problem with part number two there is the quantities are so low that sometimes you don't make a big difference. But legumes, we have a sea of nitrogen around us, use biological nitrogen fixation. So this is a case of it. At scale, a 1 hectare farm, if a farmer can manage to go to 30% of that farm in a beautiful legume, and this is something really nice to happening there, and you can see that you can be sure that in the rotational maize, you can actually grow the maize more optimally. So I'll not show much data on this because a lot of our graduate students are doing process study on this. So scale is important. Having 2 hectares and you have 10% of the farm on legumes, and then you claim to do crop rotations, there is a big misfit. So we are pushing for scale, and then scale will make the difference. And also, we don't shy to talk biochemistry with our partners, including extension. You know, you are growing specific variety of soybean, and you just say use rhizobia and so on, and they don't quite understand where it's coming from. We try to demystify science, simplify these things that we talk with our graduate students, and they will understand exactly why it's important to use rhizobia the right way, because the plant and the microbes must communicate. So that's important, And those are some of the things that many of you think it's not possible. But it's possible to talk with people who have not been to university. They begin to understand rhizobiology in very simple terms, in their own terms. So good harvest with good rainfall results in surplus food within communities, creating a local safety net in case of drought during the following season. That's part of building resilience. Now, the second case study is harnessing rainfall and the case in Malawi. We started this work just a couple of years ago. And the idea is we are trying to harness as much water as possible. Irrigation is key, but it needs investments. And the majority of communities will not access that. So without irrigation, a severe drought with rain-fed agriculture is imminent. So it's an imminent disaster. El Nino comes, definitely we can't do much. But if we have dry spells, 15-day dry spell, 20-day dry spell, we can do something about simple practice that harness maximum rainwater. And of course, the agronomy, early planting, and so on. Again, I've shown you this slide already. There's a lot of labor put in, an extra labor to tie the ridges, and then you get this. You are able to increase the residence time of water. You know, storms, those who have done some soil physics, you know, sometimes intensity of rainfall, 50, 60 millimeters per hour, and your infiltration capacity is limited to 20, 30 millimeters. So it means you lose a lot of your water. Yet you can do, actually you lose a lot of water before the soil profile is full. So what you can simply do is increase the residence time. Then you infiltrate all that water. And that is part of what we can gain in extra few days in, when drought strikes. So this practice practically mitigates negative effects of dry spells at critical growth stages. And I'd want to contend that if you can stretch your moisture by 10 days, that can be the difference between a success and failure. And I have passion for this, and we try to demonstrate this, and our graduate students go in every week, try to track soil moisture and write their thesis, of course, but show to our partners that this works. And then the flexibility of the system is embedded in that you can actually destroy the ties if you have too much rainfall. So it's flexible. It's not like you end up with waterlogging and so on. It's a La Nina, so there's so much rainfall in Southern Africa, you destroy this and you release your thing. And then my final case study is making science makes nutrition sense with farmers. I'm not a nutritionist, but we have partners who, on the project, who are working with communities on nutrition. One of the things that happen is sometimes farmers have not produced enough for household consumption, but still they'll sell to the market. And there are different models, but the income from that does not necessarily go to nutrition. You know, there are most pressing needs, schools and so on, fees and so on. Yeah, so we try first to train farmers. There's a nutrition department at Luana, the local university. We do this a lot with fun, with joy, working with women farmers as well as men. Once they understand this, then it's easier to start talking about how then do we make sure that in the household we can keep a proportion of what of our produce for local consumption for the children? So this is what we then do. So we train on dehulling, and if you dehull this, then it means nobody will be able to buy that. So it means it's secure, it's sequestered on the farm. So this can be used for local consumption. So these are the products and that can actually be done in the local environment, in the villages, and farmers are able then to consume a substantial part of the legumes they produce. And this is part of what we think can build resilience, can build healthy communities, healthy families. And I could conclude with these few statements. Resilience building is multifaceted. tailor interventions based on deep understanding of constraints and opportunities within the communities. Poor soil fertility is directly linked to poverty by farming households. Therefore, use fertility-improving technologies to break the poverty cycle. And finally, in the absence of irrigation infrastructure, simple water harvesting in situ plus good nutrient management reduces severity of dry spells. And that's a part of how we can do practically to build resilient communities. I thank you.